you don't see these kind of differences in mortalities all that often.
We intubate a lot.
This is one of our stud papers of the year.
Frankly, the results were a little bit surprising. This was an exciting positive trial.
So how does this change my practice?
ECPR is not a cure for cardiac arrest.
Where you choose to do this makes a difference.
Welcome everyone to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcoming all of you to our first podcast here in 2024. We wish all of you a very happy new year. We hope that you had a wonderful, wonderful holiday season with family, friends, and got to really take a moment, pause from all of the hard work that you do, and spend some quality time with those that you care about most. We are so excited that you are joining us here for the first podcast here in the new year. And as always, consistent with the last many, many years, we like to take a look back. What were a few key articles from the 2023 critical care and resuscitation literature? A few things that we covered throughout the year. Now, importantly, we are not going to do an exhaustive deep dive on all of these studies because in many cases, we've done that throughout 2023. So we'd ask that each of you, if you have questions, concerns, or want to get even more in the weeds in some of these studies, go back and listen to those podcasts that are available on the website. For this discussion, we're just going to hit the key take-home points. What is it that we feel you should know as we move into 2024 and take care of and resuscitate critically ill patients? So before we get started on article number one, let me welcome my co-hosts, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Peter, happy new year. Hope the holidays went well. How are you during this recording?
Doing great. Thank you. And happy new year to our listeners. Hope everybody's doing well. Excited to start the new year off with one of my favorite things, which is just the review of the resuscitative literature. So this is awesome.
I love this podcast as well. Dr. Rodriguez, happy new year to you and hope all is well.
Everything's going great. Excited for the new year. And I likewise love this podcast. It's my favorite of the year.
Outstanding. Dr. Greenwood, you can't disagree. You got to keep it going here. Happy new year and hope things are going well.
Absolutely. Things are great. And I'm excited. I just received my assignment for the AAEM pre-conference, resuscitation pre-conference, which I'm sure will touch on some of this. So looking forward to that coming up in a few months also.
Some great, great conferences early in the new year here in 2024. And with respect to AAEM, hoping to see many of you in Austin, Texas. All right, well, let's get started. Let's take a quick look back through the 2023 literature. Peter, I'm going to go to you first. Well, we intubate a lot. We intubate in the emergency department. We intubate in the ICU, and sometimes we intubate on the floor if we're responding to any patients who are rapidly decompensated. And over the years, we've had that new technology. I guess you can't really say it's new anymore, but video laryngoscopy. And there has been, ever since that hit the market, a debate as to which is better, direct laryngoscopy, video laryngoscopy, which is better, perhaps, let's just say, level of training, difficulty of airway. Does it lead to any improved outcomes? Well, Peter, what was the article that you want to go over with respect to RSI as it pertains to DL versus VL?
Right. So this is one of our stud papers of the year. It's called the DEVICE trial. This is Brian Driver, Prakur, and Trent, who looked at this before with the objective to compare the first pass success rate of direct and video laryngoscopy in critically ill adults. Their primary outcome is obviously first pass success, so I won't go into that. They looked at over 1,400 patients who met that criteria, and really the take-home point for our listeners and a reminder is that video laryngoscopy was associated with a significant increase in intubation first pass success. The other points being, the more junior you were in your experience, that intubator found greater success with VL in first pass success. So if you were naive or young in your career, you had a greater benefit from VL. And the more difficult the airway was, or was anticipated to be. So if you graded it out as a difficult airway, absolutely the more helpful video laryngoscopy was for first pass success. And so really, that's the big message. Sadly, though, even across the U.S., video isn't everywhere. In fact, we may see it in some of the EMS companies, but not in the small EDs across the country. So we need to get this tool across the board, particularly in critical access EDs.
Well said, Peter. And as you highlighted, this is, I think, one of the key papers from 2023. I think it's one of the largest randomized paper to look at DL versus VL. And you hit the high points and the big take-home messages for our listeners. And I think the paper itself used roughly 25 intubations as their threshold. So less than 25, you had indicated that, you know, kind of just a little less experienced, and VL really increased first pass success along with difficult airway. So thanks so much, Peter, for getting us started off with a key article from 2023. Well, Dr. Greenwood, I'm going to turn to you because you are our expert on ECPR, and it is a hot topic. It's been a hot topic for quite some time in terms of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And well, having said that, some in-hospital cardiac arrest patients, we do activate ECMO or the ECPR team, but there still remains relatively scant evidence as to whether this very complex therapy actually yields improved outcome. Tell us what got published in 2023 on ECPR.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. So this was the Inception trial, and this was published in New England Journal this past year. And people were really excited about this because it followed up a smaller RCT published in Lancet now about 2 years ago from Dimitri Yiannopoulos' group, which in their very small RCT had significant benefit in mortality and outcomes. So this was a much larger trial. So this was multi-center. It occurred over 4 years in 10 centers over in the Netherlands. And we all know in Northern Europe, they seem to have really good cardiac arrest outcomes. They have high rates of bystander CPR, and those patients tend to do really well. So adding this to their armamentarium, you must think, well, they know what they're doing. This is going to be a positive trial. So we're really excited to see what their results were. And what they did was they randomized patients at the 15-minute mark of standard ACLS as being refractory cardiac arrest. And these were all VTVF patients. And after they were identified and they were randomized to either ECPR or conventional care. And the primary outcome here was survival with favorable neurologic outcomes. So something we all think is really, really important in the resuscitation community. And this was a really low CPC score, 1 or 2 at 30 days. And frankly, the results were a little bit surprising. They enrolled a good number of patients, so 160 patients. In total, 26 were excluded. So about 70 were enrolled to the ECPR arm and 64 were in the conventional arm. But what did they find? Unfortunately, they found there was no difference in 30-day survival with favorable neurologic outcome. In fact, the p-value, if you're into statistics, was right down the middle, 0.5. In their secondary outcomes, there was no difference in 3 or 6 months outcomes as well. But as we talked about, if you guys remember, we talked about a lot of limitations to the Inception trial. Certainly, we found that there was a lack of standardized protocols for ECPR at different institutions. There were a number of institutions where they were learning how to do ECPR as they were enrolling patients in the trial. The numbers of cannulations at these smaller institutions also was really not equal across the board. So the experience here, the message I think the take home here is the institutional experience is probably a really important factor that's going to drive outcomes if you're going to use ECPR. Some other limitations that we talked about in that podcast, I think that ultimately the large variations in how these institutions were incorporated in the trial was really what drove this null outcome. So I think our take home point here is that, as we all know, ECPR is not a cure for cardiac arrest. It is not a substitute for high-quality ACLS. That's the bones of resuscitation and critical care. But it could serve as a bridge to therapy and good outcomes in some patients. We just need to figure out who and how to do it properly. Experience of taking care of these patients is really, really important. And I think that's part of the reason why the Minnesota group has really driven the positive studies in this area of research. So certainly something to keep an eye out for, and definitely an important addition to the resuscitation literature nonetheless in 2022.
Outstanding summary, John. Thanks so much. And you said it perfectly there with respect to ECPR. Well, Dr. Rodriguez, let's shift from cardiac arrest. Plus minus, we use ECPR, but let's just say we get ROSC. Now we're in that post-cardiac arrest care. And many times in the podcast over the previous years, we've talked about this approach in the post-cardiac arrest patient of optimizing oxygenation, ventilation, optimizing hemodynamics, looking aggressively for seizures, getting patients off to cath lab with a pre or post-arrest STEMI, maybe TTM, depending on what your feelings are with respect to targeted temperature management. But getting back to optimizing ventilation, there has been some thought that maybe mild hypercapnia may result in cerebrovasal dilatation, may help augment cerebral blood flow, may help actually improve cerebral outcomes. But we really haven't had any study until this one in 2023 to help inform us what would be optimal PaCO2 targets. So what have you got for us?
Yeah, Mike. So thanks for the great setup. This is the TAME trial by lead investigator was Eastwood. And this was a large international trial, 63 centers in 17 countries. It's a very large trial. This was an investigator-initiated open-label randomized trial, so not blinded, and they sought to test the hypothesis that targeted mild hypercapnia improves neurological outcomes at 6 months as compared to targeted normal capnia in adults with coma with ROSC after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And what they mean by mild hypercapnia, they're targeting a PCO2 of 50 to 55 as compared to targeted normal capnia, which would be, in this study, 35 to 45. And so the bottom line in this study is they enrolled 1,700 patients at these 63 different intensive care units and emergency departments. Their primary outcome was favorable neurological outcome at 6 months, and they were almost exactly evenly matched in terms of that primary outcome, as well as other secondary outcomes like death at 6 months. And so really the bottom line on this study and the take-home point is that targeted mild hypercapnia did not improve 6 month neurological outcome compared with normal capnia. So sort of very definitive study in my view, closing the door on trying to manipulate PCO2 and ventilation after cardiac arrest.
Outstanding, Rob. I think that's a great take-home message. So let me ask you this follow-up question. So when you are adjusting ventilation, thinking about oxygenation, it sounds like we should continue to target normocapnia. So say a PaCO2 in that 35 to 45 range.
Yeah, I would say so. Then again, that targeted normocapnia was not any better than the mild hypercapnia. So I guess you can really, in one sense, not kind of worry about it, just kind of keep it in the 35 to 55 range since both arms did the same.
Sounds good. Well, for the next article, I'm going to take this one and stay in that post-cardiac arrest care. And the next article really deals with imaging. So think to yourself, you've gotten ROSC, you're doing all of those interventions, you're doing a protocolized approach to the post-cardiac arrest management, trying to get the patient upstairs, and well, do you mind scanning the patient as they head upstairs, looking possibly for the etiology and any complications? And that brings us to an article we reviewed in 2023 termed the CT First cohort study. This appeared in Resuscitation. And in essence, these investigators wanted to compare standard of care with standard of care plus a whole body CT scan within 6 hours of hospital arrival. So that pan CT that many of you think about it. And in essence, what they did is compare this pan CT, or what they termed a sudden death CT protocol, with a historical cohort. Importantly, that historical cohort got a post-arrest EKG looking for STEMI, got a post-arrest echo, and then also a non-contrast head CT. So that already was their standard of care. They compared it to this sudden death protocol, whereby they still got the post-arrest EKG, the echo, but now with imaging, they had the non-contrast head CT and added a thoracic CT, So chest CT with an EKG gated portion for a coronary angiogram, and then a venous phase of the abdomen and pelvis. So that sort of pan CT. And ultimately, they wanted to know, well, this protocol of adding the chest and abdomen, did it increase the diagnostic yield compared to that standard of care cohort historical control? And in essence, they had a pretty good amount of patients in this study, just under 250. And the take-home message was, yes, their sudden death protocol, so non-con head CT, EKG-gated CTA of the chest along with venous phase runoff to the abdomen and pelvis, improved the diagnostic accuracy, identifying the etiology of the out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and also diagnosed complications or diagnosed time-critical conditions much, much sooner than the standard of care cohort. Now, importantly, they did look at survival. Did it improve survival? This was a secondary outcome. It didn't. But I think, as you recall, for those of you that have listened to that podcast, we feel that provided that there's opportunity, imaging patients with, say, this protocol or a pan CT following arrest does help us to identify more etiologies and also more timely identify critical conditions that we need to know about and potentially intervene upon in a shorter period of time following resuscitation. All right, Dr. W., I'm turning back to you because sepsis, it is your area of expertise. I love listening to your sepsis lectures everywhere I can. And on the podcast, all four of us have talked about fluids and sepsis resuscitation, earlier pressor use, and well, we've got an addition to that sepsis literature in 2023. What would that be?
This is the CLOVERS trial, a very exciting trial for me in its design. And what it looked at was the early restrictive or liberal fluid management for sepsis-induced hypotension. A New England Journal article, Nate Shapiro is the lead author. So the objective is to compare the effects of a restricted fluid strategy with the early institution of vasopressors and compare that to a liberal fluid strategy in the first 24 hours of resuscitation in patients with sepsis-induced hypotension. So the methods, it's a multi-centered, randomized, unblinded superiority trial over 60 U.S. centers. This looked at adults. They were randomized one-to-one to either a restrictive fluid strategy, prioritizing the vasopressors as the primary treatment for sepsis-induced hypotension, and then rescue fluids were permitted for a pre-specified indication that suggested severe intravascular volume depletion. And we compared that with the liberal strategy, which was recommended an initial 2-liter IV fluid bolus infusion, followed by serial fluid boluses on the basis of clinical triggers. And the fluid was given for things like persistent tachycardia, and then rescue vasopressors were permitted for pre-specified indications. And these groups were followed for the following 24 hours, with the primary outcome being death from any cause before discharge home by day 90. The secondary outcomes were all the litany of ICU things that we look for, like mechanical ventilation, renal replacement therapy, dialysis, days free from vasopressors, days out of the ICU, and days out of the hospital. So what did the results look like? They enrolled a total of over 1,500 patients with 782 in the restrictive strategy and 781 in the liberal strategy. They were equivalent at baseline. The primary outcome, this death from any cause, in the restricted strategy, 14%, and in the liberal strategy, 14.9%. So no real statistical difference between the two groups, and the secondary outcomes, no differences either. Interesting, the safety outcomes, a number of serious adverse events was similar in both groups, and important for us to know with this institution of early vasopressors being predominantly oftentimes in peripheral lines, they had 3 extravasation events and none of those required any sort of intervention. And so really the take-home point here for the CLOVERS trial is a restricted fluid strategy with the early institution of vasopressors did not result in a lower or higher mortality before discharge home by day 90 in sepsis-induced hypotension.
Some important results. Very surprising, Peter.
Very surprising for those of us that had a bias that early institution of vasopressors was the way to go. We still argue and debate the benefits of fluid boluses and how much is the right amount and what does that look like and what does the science look like that is leading us to do what we currently do. So this is helpful.
Yep, an important study from 2023. Well, I want to stay in the septic shock box. And Rob, go back to you because you brought us an article in 2023, an important article, once again, some thought-provoking findings, practice-changing, whereby it talks about fludrocortisone. Remind us about that article that we reviewed.
Yeah, Mike. This is one of my favorite articles of 2023, even though it's not a randomized trial, it's an observational study. And this is the comparing effectiveness of fludrocortisone and hydrocortisone versus hydrocortisone alone among patients with septic shock study. And the lead investigator was Bosch. And this came out in JAMA Internal Medicine. And their objective in this study was to compare the effectiveness of the combination of hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone versus hydrocortisone alone in patients admitted with septic shock. And this was a large multi-center observational study using a big database that was included multiple ICUs from 2016 to 2020. And in this database, it's reportedly includes 20% of US inpatient hospitalizations in this database. So it's a very, very large database. And what they looked at was comparing patients with septic shock who were admitted to the ICU or a step-down unit who received hydrocortisone alone versus those who received hydrocortisone plus fludrocortisone. And as you recall, fludrocortisone is a mineralocorticoid that is delivered orally. As far as I know, it can only be delivered by the enteral route, so by NG tube. And so in this trial, they had 88,275 patients who met inclusion criteria. And the much greater proportion of that group had received hydrocortisone alone. About 86,000 of the 88,275 received hydrocortisone alone. And the other 2,280 received both hydrocortisone and fludrocortisone. And in terms of their primary outcome, which was death or discharge to hospice, the hydrocortisone, fludrocortisone group had a rate of 47.2% as compared to 50.8% in the hydrocortisone alone group. And that resulted in an adjusted risk difference of 3.7% difference in mortality, basically. Then that difference was highly statistically significant, favoring the hydrocortisone, fludrocortisone group. In terms of secondary outcomes, they also tended to favor the combination hydrocortisone, fludrocortisone group. Of course, now the take-home points from this are that the addition of fludrocortisone may be associated with decreased mortality and less vasopressor use and more hospital-free days, and it should be considered to be added to your standard hydrocortisone therapy for patients with severe septic shock. And again, you know, this is a highly limited study because it's observational. It's not a randomized trial, but there have been other randomized trials and studies that have showed similar trends and similar signal. And in fact, I just read a paper from a meta-analysis of trials and studies looking at that exact comparison, fludrocortisone plus hydrocortisone versus hydrocortisone alone. And that paper indicates a favorable response with the addition of fludrocortisone. So how does this change my practice? Fludrocortisone is a cheap drug. It's really virtually no real major side effects or safety effects that have been shown in the studies. So I am routinely adding fludrocortisone to my severe septic shock cocktail in addition to hydrocortisone. I don't know what the rest of you are doing.
Well, you've certainly helped to convince us, Rob, with respect to the review of this particular study and even bringing in some more recent articles, or an article that we didn't have a chance to cite but has been published since we did that podcast. So really outstanding review and strong points when making the addition of flugicortisone. All right, Dr. Greenwood, I'm going to sort of stay in the sepsis kind of box and maybe still the steroid kind of box. And well, all of us have been practicing long enough to just continue to see that pendulum swing back and forth on corticosteroids and critical illness. What article got published that deals with that in 2023?
All right. Yeah. So now that I'm taking a look back, this is a pretty epic year for critical care clinical research. We had a lot of positive randomized control trials in critical care compared to usual. I'm used to seeing, you know, negative trial left and right, nothing works. And then there's some reasons for why we didn't pick the right treatment group, this, that, and the third. But this was an exciting positive trial. So this was the Cape Cod trial, and this was written by Pierre Dequin and a group in France that looked at the use of hydrocortisone in severe community-acquired pneumonia. And their objective was to evaluate essentially whether hydrocort reduced mortality at 28 days among patients admitted to the ICU with severe community-acquired pneumonia. And we'll talk about this more specifically, but these weren't patients with septic shock. These were only patients with severe CAP. So this was a randomized double-blind controlled trial in 31 centers across France. And they included adults, basically, who met one of four criteria. So they had to have CAP that required either mechanical ventilation, high flow nasal cannula, or a low PF ratio of less than 300. So I think we're seeing this general trend of using less mechanical ventilation when possible. So it was great to see that they included high flow nasal cannula patients in this. Those patients with CAP who required non-rebreather, perhaps they didn't have high flow nasal cannula available, or had a very high pneumonia severity index score. And once they were randomized either 1-to-1 to either control group who received saline, a placebo, or hydrocortisone. Now, if you remember back, this was a little bit funky in terms of how they treated their patients with hydrocort. They used this specific algorithm that decided whether or not they would receive an 8-day treatment duration or a full 14-day treatment duration of hydrocortisone. And if you're interested in the details, please do go back to either listen to our podcast or review the outline, because we kind of talk about it more explicitly in the outline online. Their primary outcome, as we said, was survival with favorable neurologic outcome at 30 days. But they also looked at secondary outcomes, which include a little bit more longer-term mortality, 90 days, those who did not progress onto mechanical ventilation, delayed endotracheal intubation rates, as well as adverse events. Well, what'd they find? Well, the results were pretty impressive. Almost 800 patients enrolled in the final analysis, so about 400 in the hydrocortisone arm and 400 in the placebo arm, that were really well matched. They did a great job looking at kind of equal patient groups. Most of these patients received high flow nasal cannula, about 40% of patients, in fact, but the remainder of patients, about 20%, did receive invasive mechanical ventilation as well. Now, what did they find? Well, bottom line is they found that hydrocortisone treatment, the group randomized to this arm, had decreased mortality at 28 days. And it wasn't by a little bit. The hydrocortisone group had about a 6% mortality compared to placebo group of almost 12%. So this was a pretty significant statistical difference, but practically speaking, a pretty big difference overall. You don't see these kind of differences in mortalities all that often. So certainly there were no difference in most of the secondary clinical outcomes worth talking about. They really drilled down to these, well, maybe which groups had the most benefit or really benefit from hydrocortisone. It was the patients who did not receive mechanical ventilation. Women stood out, those with a really high pneumonia severity index, and the elderly, not elderly, but we'll just call them age greater than 65. I know we kind of use that term loosely. The limitations identified by the authors, certainly the observed mortality was lower in the control group than expected. They were really thinking that they were going to see a 27% mortality in the placebo group, which they did not. So essentially, their takeaway from that was we enrolled patients that weren't maybe as severely ill as we thought. But to be honest, that's not very uncommon in these large randomized control trials. So take home point, bottom line, what's the change in practice thing here that we've even started incorporating into our treatment program here at Penn is to really strongly consider the use of hydrocortisone for patients with severe CAP in the ICU, even if they're not on invasive mechanical ventilation.
Thanks so much, John. That was outstanding. And yes, another positive trial. And did we ever find an answer as to why this French study was called the Cape Cod trial?
No, perhaps they took a small vacation in the summertime and it really resonated with them, but I couldn't figure out that mnemonic at all.
All right. Well, remains to be answered. Well, just two more articles that we want to touch on briefly here before we wrap this year in review podcast up. Peter, I'm going to turn back to you. And speaking of another positive study, let's hit on a procedure-related article, and that has to deal with platelet transfusions prior to central venous line in those with severe thrombocytopenia. Tell us a little bit more about the PACER trial.
So the PACER trial, published in New England Journal of Medicine, their objective was to evaluate the hypothesis that the omission of prophylactic platelet transfusions before central venous catheter placement in patients with platelets between 10,000 and 50,000 would not increase the risk of catheter-related bleeding. Would not. So the methods, a multicenter randomized controlled non-inferiority trial conducted at 10 hospitals in the Netherlands, and it was really conducted in the ICU and the hematology unit. So for the patients, all central venous catheter procedures in patients with platelets between 10,000 and 50,000 within 24 hours of the procedure. So the trial procedures, patients were randomized and assigned in a one-to-one ratio to either receive one unit of platelets before the central venous catheter placement or not. It required central venous catheter placement using ultrasound by an experienced operator. They had to have performed at least 50 ultrasound-guided central venous catheter placements. And the catheters could be either tunneled or not tunneled, and they could be placed in the IJ, subclavian, or femoral veins. So the primary outcome for the study, for the PACER, was occurrence of catheter-related bleeding of a grade 2 to 4 within 24 hours of placement. So grade 0 is no bleeding. Grade 1 is a little bit of oozing that resulted in less than 20 minutes of manual compression to stop. Now, the ones they were looking at were grade 2, which needed minor intervention to stop, such as compression for greater than 20 minutes, or grade 3, which needed radiologic or elective operative intervention or red cell transfusion, but maintained hemodynamic stability. Grade 4 was kind of like the yard sale. It's associated with severe hemodynamic instability. Some of the secondary outcomes, major bleeding, grades 3 or 4, and then platelet and red cell transfusions within 24 hours after central venous catheter placement. So what were the results? In total, they looked at ultimately 373 included in the final analysis. And then the primary outcome of a grade 2 to 4 catheter-related bleeding was 4.8% in the transfusion group. And then in those that didn't receive the platelet transfusion, their primary outcome of grade 2 to 4 catheter-related bleeding was 11.9%. So 4.8 to 11.9. Non-inferiority was not shown. Secondary outcome, again, the risk of a grade 3 or grade 4 central venous catheter-related bleeding in the transfusion group, 2.1%. In the no transfusion group, 4.9%. So the no transfusion group received more platelet transfusions in the 24 hours after catheter placement. The ICU length of stay was slightly shorter in the no transfusion group. Mortality was similar between the two. The bleeding risk among patients being treated on the hematology ward was higher than those among patients in the ICU. So where you choose to do this makes a difference. The bleeding risk was also higher with the use of tunneled catheters compared to non-tunneled central venous catheters. So what's really the take-home point for all of this? In patients with severe thrombocytopenia withholding prophylactic platelet transfusions before central venous catheter placement in those with a platelet count of 10 to 50,000 resulted in more central venous catheter-related bleeding than prophylactic platelet transfusion. The authors, however, go on to advocate for a real personalized approach. They thought, consider prophylactic transfusion in patients with platelet counts less than 30,000, especially those who wind up on the hematology ward. And then for patients in the ICU, consider a no transfusion strategy with intensive monitoring and low threshold for therapeutic use of blood products. So they put a very personal spin on their study that showed that if you didn't choose to transfuse folks before, you wound up with more bleeding risks.
Yep. Key point there, Peter. Thanks for taking the time to review that. I think that's another critical paper from 2023. We don't do many procedure-related papers and really highlights, well, in these particular patients, it may be beneficial. Still, personalized approach, but thinking more, being proactive in platelet transfusions. All right, Dr. Rodriguez, bring us home. The final article, briefly, we touched on this more recently, and it's an area that we don't hit on that often with respect to trauma, critical care, and resuscitation. And similar to ECPR, a lot of interest in REBOA. Tell us about the UK REBOA trial.
Yeah. So, Mike, this is a procedure that I've only seen once or twice. It's not commonly used in my department. And this is resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta in trauma patients, and that stands for REBOA. And so this was a trial in the UK that was published in JAMA in October of this year. And the objective of this study was to examine the effectiveness of REBOA plus standard care compared to standard care alone for the management of uncontrolled traumatic hemorrhage. And so this was an open label, obviously had to be open label, Bayesian group sequential registry enabled randomized clinical trial at 16 major trauma centers in the UK. And they included adults who presented with major trauma and confirmed or suspected life-threatening torso hemorrhage deemed amenable to REBOA. And they randomized patients 1-to-1 to either REBOA plus standard care or standard care alone. And really just want to jump to the punchline. Their primary outcome was all-cause mortality at 90 days. And they enrolled 90 patients in this study. And the groups were evenly matched, 46 patients in the REBOA and 44 patients in the standard care group. And what they found was that the all-cause 90-day mortality was 54% in the REBOA group versus 42% in the standard care group. And the odds ratios for mortality at 6 months and in the hospital and at 24, 6, and 3 hours, which were their secondary outcomes, were also increased with REBOA as compared to standard care. And there were a lot of limitations in this study. Overall, it's a relatively kind of a small sample size. There were some baseline differences between the two groups, and the fact that it was performed in the UK where blunt trauma predominates makes it perhaps less generalizable to the US and other countries. But the take-home point from this study was that REBOA, in addition to standard care, did not reduce 90-day all-cause mortality compared to standard care alone. And in fact, there's, you know, a strong signal that it may have been associated with increased mortality. So this paper had a lot of press, obviously, in the surgical community. And, you know, it's really kind of a questioned use of REBOA.
Thanks so much, Rob. Thanks so much, John and Peter. This has been super helpful. And while we go a little bit long on this podcast compared to our usual 25 to 30 minutes, this is always a helpful discussion to lead off the new year, taking a look back at some key articles, certainly not all articles that were published in 2023, but a few that touch on some key common things that we see and do: RSI, ultrasound guided lines, cardiac arrest, sepsis, post-arrest care, and taking care of, say, community acquired pneumonia. So in general, super, super helpful Once again, Happy New Year to everyone tuning in here on CCPEM to listen. We hope this has been helpful for you. We are so looking forward to the year ahead with you and all of the great papers, information, and discussion that lies ahead. We will look forward to speaking with you on our next podcast. Bye for now.